Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow with just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the CBI Network.
Find them on Facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Love and Romance After TBI. Hello, welcome to another month of Surviving Head Trauma. I'm Terry Smith, your host.
And I'm Michelle. Hi, everybody.
Michelle. Hello, Michelle. Yes. How are you this evening?
Hey. I'm great, handsome. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm excited for you. You're in Cancun, I understand, this evening.
Well, yes, I've gone. Yes. Cancun, Playa del Carmen, and Tulum.
So right.
Gone away for the weekend, a little quick getaway.
So we really are all the way live. Yes, and beautiful.
We are
island.
All the way live.
All the way live.
I just finished a lovely dinner, and so I'll send you some pictures of it. It was good. And now I'm just relaxing and thinking about our show.
All right. Well, let's welcome our audience. Welcome, listeners. It's been a month since we've been seeing you on air here. We'd like to welcome you and give you our phone number so that you can join us this evening if you'd like to call us. We're in country code 1 if you're out of the United States. If you're in the States, the area code is 424-243-9540. That's 424-243-9540. And you can also reach us on the internet, blogtalkradio.com/BrainInjuryRadio. And you can reach us that way and chat with us live and see the show that way. So we also like to thank our station owner, Craig Cecilia. He pays the bills around here and gives us a voice on air to the silent epidemic of brain trauma. And Kim Justice, our station network manager, who makes everyone's schedule and all the hosts and all the shows. There's a show every night of the week on Brain Injury Radio Network. So join us every night of the week for a different show. And Surviving Head Trauma is also a book. It's a book that I wrote. I'm the author of Surviving Head Trauma, the book. So you can order that anywhere books are sold and find it on my website even. And every episode of this podcast on terrysmithbooks.com. And you can write to us and send us your emails and your letters, rather, to Surviving Head Trauma on Facebook page. So you have so many ways to reach us. Michelle, did I cover everything? Michelle's in Cancun. She's probably distracted by
everything.
The ocean.
No. I just didn't want to have too much background noise. But yes, I think you covered everything. You did.
Okay. Well, we're ready to rock and roll for this month. And the question or the statement is love and romance after brain injury. The question is, could a person with TBI start and have a healthy romantic relationship? My boyfriend, girlfriend, who has a TBI, can go from bringing me flowers and telling me he loves me to other times making me thank me for dinner like I'm just any friend of the family. That's a question this Emily asks. And the answer to that question is yes. Following brain injury, individuals can and do start and maintain healthy, loving, committed relationships. In fact, in studies investigating the stability of romantic relationships after the brain injury, results have shown couples have less of a likelihood of separating than those couples who do not in the general population. So that's a lot of conversation. But Michelle?
Well, it is. Yes, yes. You covered a lot there.
Sorry.
You covered a lot. I think, you know, all of it is work, you know?
Like any
relationship. So all the relationships are work, yeah. But where you get into kind of a gray area is before TBI and after TBI, there's so many differences and changes that a person can come.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah,
that's a lot of the doctors and many of the articles we've researched have said, and that's dealing with the new person, and in order for people with a TBI to maintain a healthy, loving, romantic relationship, they will need support, encouragement, and understanding from their partner. While this sounds like
that's
a recipe for success of any romantic relationship, there are specific ways in which people with brain injury will need to be supported. There are also commitments that people with brain injury will need to make to themselves, their partner, the relationship, in order to sustain relational happiness and security over the long term. Because, I mean, the partners of people who have TBI have to educate themselves about how brain trauma impacts the individual. So there's so many
right.
steps to it. Many people who have to contribute, the person who has the brain trauma and the person that they're romantically involved with, they both have to research it.
Well, right. It's an ongoing process. I mean, relationships are changing all the time. But obviously when maybe you're in this relationship, there's before the TBI and then there's after. And also, if you're meeting someone, like starting a new relationship, you know, there may be things that are overwhelming to you or you just are not able to cope with that a person without a TBI can cope with. Maybe it's noise, maybe it's crowds, you know, a lot of things going on.
Irritability. Because it's a new person, so dealing the person without the brain injury is now dealing with a new person, and meaning depending on the severity, that's a criteria we need to make note. There's various levels of brain injury, so depending on the severity of the brain injury, the person could change mildly or dramatically, and now you're dealing with a virtual stranger. And that, like we started with this conversation with Emily, she was saying. You know, he treated her like she was just any friend of the family all of a sudden. So we, have a new person to deal with. So we now have to recognize this new person. And now we may not like this new person. Maybe the new person's a pain in the ass. So what do we do then? I mean,
the life of the party.
The life of the party. I think Michelle's the life of the party in Cancun right now, but we can progress by saying that they're partners, and we've already said they need to educate themselves, the partners, if they want to stay in this attentive relationship, because it takes a lot of attention and time. But individuals with brain injury often experience changes in behavioral, social, and emotional functioning. So in a relationship, partners often read the emotional and social cues of their partners in order to gauge the stability of the relationship. However, after TBI, some disruption and emotions and challenges with communications are to be expected. So people who understand brain injury can learn to interpret changes in their partner's mood and their partner's willingness to interact socially in the new, more accurate way. So education can also help partners not to personalize the behaviors, like the anger outbursts, the reclusiveness, the strange behaviors that make you out on a date somewhere maybe and suddenly have to leave because of an anxiety attack or some gastrial issues, because the stomach is a melting pot of emotions of the body. So often when you're out and you're angst. Stomach is a place of punches felt, and you need to get out. You need to leave and get out and leave and leave and leave, and it happens over and over sometimes. So you need to understand that behavior if you're with someone like that until they are more comfortable in that environment with this new person, or someone they've known a long time. It depends upon the severity of the individual. And people who understand brain injury can learn to interpret the changes. We've already said that. We want to go back to, in addition to building a knowledge base about common symptoms of TBI, partners can learn strategies for new ways to de-escalate an argument. Remember, we just talked about arguments being dominant, because after brain trauma, the trigger is so easy to pull for that emotion, the anger emotion, and containing it is not always easy, especially in the beginning, the early days. As you get older, you just get too weak and tired to deal with that kind of craziness, so you stop it. We don't like to use the word craziness, but you get the point, the idea. And what we do is we after learning how to de-escalate an argument so that it doesn't go into the deep end and off the edge of the cliff, we identify early signs of the partner's stress or anger. So once you identify it, you share your own needs and emotional response or connection with that partner. Again, while these may be important skills for any romantic relationship, and the way in which a partner de-escalates an argument when their spouse has or mate has a TBI will be different from the approach used by couples where the brain injury is not a concern, because reading information written by caregivers, attending family members, support groups, and meetings with a therapist who has a therapist who has a familiarity with brain injury and all solid ways to build the effective skill set. So, of course, maintenance of a healthy relationship always requires the dedication of both partners, and it's an ongoing process which we learn throughout time and through experience. So it's not an overnight thing, and sometimes relationships can be jeopardized in those early days because the partner of the TBI patient may not understand that this is a natural result of what's happened neurologically, and just feel that this is a new person and I don't want to deal with this. I don't have the patience or the inkling to do so. So that relationship is doomed. But for those who decide to stay, people with brain injuries can improve the likelihood that their relationship will succeed by attending therapy focused on emotional regulation and compensatory strategy development. Additionally, by focusing on building communication skills, asking for help, and focusing on the positive, survivors can enhance the emotional connection they have with their partners. And then in the final stages, when a couple enters a relationship, after one person has a brain injury, they may want to consider taking a proactive stance by attending counseling with the couple's therapist who is familiar with TBI. Both emotional and physical intimacy can be impacted by brain injury. Couples counseling can assist both partners in developing strategies and coping skills that can enhance the relationship, and both individuals feel balanced. And that's the key, I think, objective when we're talking about dealing with relationships after brain trauma. So with that road laid, we're going to take a listen to someone for 37 seconds, someone who you might, if you're new to this world of brain trauma, find very helpful in your journey, the Brain Injury Association of America. It's a national organization, and if you look you'll find a chapter near you. We'll be right back.
Research, treatment, and support speed recovery for the more than 2.5 million children and adults who sustain traumatic brain injuries in the United States each year. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Support research and better access to care and let people with brain injuries know that they are not alone. Call 1-800-444-6443 or visit www.biausa.org to learn more about brain injury.
biausa.org. That's right. Give them a chance. If you're new to this, you'll appreciate contacting them. They do a lot for us, not only emotionally and support wise in your immediate area, but they do a lot of work on Capitol Hill for rights and privileges for the disabled, and that is under the umbrella where we fit. So they do a lot of work for brain trauma patients and the invisible issues that we deal with that the masses who may look at us and not know that we're even brain damaged. We have issues that can't be seen sometimes. And well, there are legislative things that can make life less complicated for those invisible illnesses that we share in the brain injury community. But tonight we're talking about love and romance after that injury, after TBI. Does it exist? Can it continue? What does it take? What does it take to make it happen? In fact, while we're on a break, let's make it a musical break. Let's find Cindy Cook and talk about rising to the occasion, because if we're going to be in this thing, we're going to have to rise to the occasion. Cindy Cook, check her out on YouTube, CYNDICOOK on YouTube. Whoops, wrong song. I'm going to try it again. Rise to the occasion, Cindy Cook. Rise to the Occasion. That's Cindy Cook. Check her out on YouTube. Thank you, Cindy Cook, for letting us play your music on Surviving Head Trauma. And it also talks about rising to the occasion. And that's what we have to do sometimes after brain trauma, is rise to the occasion of adjusting to that new person. And that new person adjusting to the people who are there and loving you and know who you are, even if you don't know who they are. It's that bad in the beginning, yes, in the beginning. So in Cancun, we almost lost you. We lost you for a while there.
I'm sorry. It was my golf cart. My golf cart, I went a little bit too far. So
we're interrupting your fun time. You stopped your fun time. Join us in the show.
Of course, because the show is fun. I couldn't miss tonight. I look forward to this all month. This is just great.
Oh, about that. She stopped her fun in Cancun to join us. Thank you, Michelle. Well, you know, it's funny that we talk in February about enjoying life and love and romance. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be with another person. We have to first start with ourselves. And
that's right.
And do things like you're doing right now. I don't know how spontaneous or who you're with or whatever, but I mean, you're loving life. You're living life and enjoying it.
Yes. Every now and then you need a change of scenery, and I don't care what your finances are, what's going on for you. Just once in a while, you know, you got to live. You got to take a break. And I do it sometimes, but I've had quite a few things happen, a lot of stress with my 16-year-old driving and new schools for the kids and trying to organize different things. So I've been doing juggling a lot of hats. And so this is just a time for me to hang out with my friends, not cook, not be involved in all the stressful situations that I have, and just kind of let my hair down a little bit with some friends. So that's what I'm doing.
And you know what? That's healthy. That's a good approach to what mental well-being, to good mental health. I mean, some people find that they can't go out anymore and they're trapped inside. So the fact that you're out and enjoying the outside world is a beautiful thing for
well,
many,
you know,
reclusive survivors.
That is an issue. You know, I mean, we're talking about how people will, your personality or things you once enjoyed doing can elude you with a brain injury. And there are times where the person who's the life of the party is suddenly afraid of crowds or doesn't want to go outside. Different things trigger them. And it's a learning experience and growing process, and a lot of patience is required for both people.
Oh, my goodness. So this is the perfect example. I can share a story with you. There's a moment, a share moment. I mean, I have so many, but the first one that pops into my mind is I was with a date, and we were at a museum. And can you hear me? There, we were at a museum.
Yes, and, I can hear you.
Okay, I was at a museum. We were at a museum, and this was years, not too many years after the head injury, but the museum I became flooded with just the people, and she had wandered off somewhere talking with people, and I was alone and didn't know anyone, and the people and the sound and the visuals of all the people and the art and it became so flooded. I became so flooded that I had to leave. I couldn't search for her. I didn't have time. I had to get out. I needed to get out of that building, and I left.
Wow.
And I know it was as inappropriate as it was to leave her without telling her that I had left. I mean, I knew that she knew everyone there. She was one of the people organizing the gala, but I just drove to her house and left the note and flowers or something on her door, and I knew that was the end of it. And that's how it was in the beginning, because I was just being out. would become too much.
Right. And this is someone you knew.
No, this is someone I met after the trauma. She didn't know me before trauma. This was me trying to go out on a new date with someone new, and we'd been dating for a little while, like a month, maybe not even a month, a few weeks. It was one of our first dates.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, so yeah, a person meeting you for the first time would actually not expect something like that, you know, to happen.
Someone to just split?
They totally would. Yeah, especially if you accepted the date and you said, oh, yeah, I'll go to your gala with you or whatever. And then just the overwhelming sense of dread or the crowd, the noise, whatever was overwhelming for you, that is totally unexpected. And so a person who doesn't know you or is getting to know you, that's really big. So imagine someone who's used to going out, having the brain trauma, and then becoming that person that is almost housebound. We talked about that before.
Yeah, that's my description. You just described my beginning, how it started. But
it makes it difficult
for a relationship, I mean, to sustain one, unless the other person becomes so familiar and comfortable that you don't get flooded like that experience I gave.
Well, did you see her again? Was that the end of the relationship?
That was it.
What happened?
That was it. That
you
was
didn't
the last
see
time.
Anymore.
No. Well, we're talking the phone.
I think people should call in. And if they have an experience, they should call in.
Let's give the phone number again and get maybe some people to share their experience with us. Give us, listening audience, if you'd like to share your story, give us a call. Country code 1, if you're not in the United States. If you are, it's area code 424-243-9540. And then
9540.
Yeah. And then when you get in queue, the little computer will guide you through a series of directions. Just press 1 on your phone and it'll let my switchboard know that you want to speak live on air. So, give us your input. What do you think about this? Relationships after brain trauma. And it's funny, we talk about this in the month of February, the love month.
Right.
Love month. And
love after
TBI. Yes. You know, there are certain common thoughts and feelings that people with brain trauma have that about this topic. I've done the research and what I've come up with to summarize it is that the common thoughts and feelings are, I can't relate to this anymore. I'd rather be alone. People are avoiding me now. What happened to everyone who came to visit in the hospital? They just don't want me to be around. Nobody returns my calls. They want to fire me. I just know it. People just don't understand me. These are common thoughts and feelings, I mean, that prevail right after, because things change so much. Again, we have to remember, we're talking about the severity of the injury, and each person's severity is different, and each person's accident, even at the same level of severity, may be different, may affect the person differently. So not one rule applies to everyone for all things. I mean,
no, that's
true.
Right. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wherever you are, whatever level of, lack of better description, I'll say your disability, don't be afraid to get some help or ask or talk to people. You know, sometimes there's just one person that's able to give you an alternate point of view that helps or points you in the right direction that gets you to the next level. So don't be stuck if it's possible. Don't stay where you are. Rehab, talking, books, the show. may offer you a glimmer of hope, and just don't give up.
You know what
the
you just said? You just said
something. Change.
You just said something magical about listening and hearing something that might change your perspective, and that's a good point. You know, they say if you listen to life, life speaks to us. And so if you're listening, you might hear a conversation other people are having in the supermarket or something, and they might say something to each other that resonates with what you're going through. So you might get
right.
messages delivered to you in ways you don't expect if you pay attention and listen to the world around you.
Yeah.
So we hear our messages in different ways. But the thing is, I think, to follow what we feel and understand what our mate is going through, whether the mate is the one with the TBI or the mate is the one who is dealing with the one with the TBI. So
the TBI, yeah.
Yeah, it can be tough, but it can work. I mean, according to statistics here in my research, it does work if both people are willing to try, and it takes an enormous amount of patience and trying, especially depending on the severity of the brain trauma.
Right.
So it says that there are different degrees, as we've said, of brain injury severity, and the less severe injuries do not always result in significant or long-term relationship changes. However, severe, moderate, or complicated mild brain injuries, both the person who has sustained the injury and his or her partner are often forced to change many parts of their lives. Perhaps most often, partners will experience a change in responsibilities or roles within their relationship. For example, the family's primary breadwinner is now unemployed and recovering, or the family's primary homemaker is now unable to care for the home and children. So those are drastic changes,
yeah.
Michelle, that aren't easily dealt with if you have a functioning household and everyone is depending on everyone's role in that household, and now someone's role is no longer functional, the entire company could collapse. In this case, the company's the family. If partners aren't willing to put in the necessary work, and it takes extra work.
Well, it really does. And you don't know how much work it's going to take until you get in that situation. And it's just a process. It's a process.
And the development of the head trauma itself, how well the head trauma, how it affects the person. Is the person thinking rationally at all times, or are there times of delusional misunderstandings? I mean, we have so many elements involved in this equation that it's hard to mathematically answer with a correct or incorrect answer. It's a matter of the same person with the same injury may interpret what you say today differently than he or she did yesterday or will tomorrow. Mind and the brain changes with the person more rapidly, I think, than the person without brain trauma. So with that fluidity, you kind of really, if you need to know this, you really need to know this person and how to read this person. One of our favorite words, perspicacious.
I do think everybody in the situation needs to just be patient. Give the injured party a little bit more space and time, grace. It does take time, and sometimes you're never the same. So, you know, I don't know.
In some cases, it doesn't work. Sometimes that the end is necessary in order to continue in a healthy way, because it may be that a restart is required with someone who
mm-hmm.
doesn't know the previous version of you.
Right, and they're willing to accept the person that you are now. I mean, what changes did you notice in yourself. I noticed some changes and others noticed before I did.
That's usually, yeah.
Did you notice something like the before?
Well, for me, the biggest thing was not knowing who anybody was. I mean, that was my first introduction to this world. I didn't, everyone around me was a stranger who seemed to know me. And I was like,
wow.
Taken aback a bit. Like, who are these people who seem to know me, telling me things about myself that I don't even know? And
wow. Okay.
Strange.
So it's almost like you were being dropped into this new world of people, like a new country, a new universe.
But they all knew me.
Everybody knew you. Yeah.
Right.
But
I didn't know who they were. So that was strange. Especially for my mother. The one person I think it hurt the most was my mother when I didn't know who she was. When she tells me the story, it makes me... I mean, she's been dead now for 21 years, but when she was alive, she would tell me the story of how I didn't know who she was, and it broke her heart. But she had to maintain...
Did you eventually... How did it... Did you not ever remember, or did bits and pieces start coming back, or did they have, like, a memory board or start showing you pictures? How did you start remembering?
Oh,
or did
that's a whole show, but yeah. My mother eventually became, I knew who she was after being awake out of the coma for a while. My sister, people who were really, really, my immediate family, I remembered. And
it started coming back on its own.
Yeah, but it was a slow process. Many of the people, when I finally went back to school after being out for so long, the people who ran up to me, Terry, welcome back. That's when I didn't get everybody's face and name back in place. They were just lost. But I was happy to know that they were cheering for my return, but who they were remained a mystery. So, so in a relationship, if you're in a vault, back to our focus with the love and romance, that can you imagine being in a relationship and your loved one waking up not knowing you?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, for me, my personality was different. You know, especially at first, I did kind of go back. Mostly, I think, but. My personality, my temper. I've always been kind of a moderate person. I won't say gentle or a pushover, but just kind of accepting and kind of go with the flow.
Calm.
And I totally, yeah, calm. I mean, you know, I was a little bit high strung certain things and maybe occupied or busy. I don't know how you would describe me, but for the most part, I was gentle, go with the flow, everybody's cool, let's all just get along. And after the brain injury, oh my gosh, I had a different, totally different temperament, tone, choice of words, just the language was different, and I still suffer a little bit of aphasia, I can't remember certain words, I have to really think, oh, what's the word? It's not that word, it's this other word. I know it. So that happens to me. But the anger and fear and forgetfulness and just the frustrating not knowing certain things that I know I knew before was really hard as the brain injured person. And having everyone look at you the same, like you're people that recognized you, and then you don't recognize them. Or you can't do what you did before. You're not the life of the party. You're a little bit more, reserved or just different.
Were
so
you involved in a relationship when you had your head injury?
Yes, I was married at the time.
You were married?
How
did your husband see you? Did he see you differently after the head injury, or did he notice a change, or what was his perception?
I'm not sure what he noticed. What I noticed was his inability to care for me and keep the family together. that I was doing quite a lot of stuff. So,
did he not take your head injury seriously, or did he not give it full credit for the severity?
I don't know. I think for him, the problem was he got used to me doing and being a certain way that when I wasn't able to do the thing, he wasn't able to do them either. So I wasn't taken care of. I had to get organized my own care team because he couldn't care for me. And there was nothing wrong with me except, you know, I could walk and do things, but I just wasn't able to manage everything, breakfast, lunch, dinner, children, and go to work. I couldn't work. So, you know, it was hard. So that kind of was an eye-opening thing that I realized, oh, hey, I got to do this stuff. I got to figure this out. So I started going to therapy. Like I said, I organized my own care team because I wasn't getting the care from the family. And I don't know if he wasn't able to or didn't want to or didn't know. I don't know, but whatever.
So, sounds like a recipe for not a happy ending with the person going through something and the other person is ambivalent or seemingly unaware or whatever.
Yeah,
this trying to understand.
It was the beginning of the end.
So it did end in.
It was the beginning of the end. Yeah.
So it was not a happy ending. Then.
I'm not married now. No.
Okay. Well, I can understand that. Yeah, I can understand that. I've been through more than one, so I've been through the trial.
You're a pro at this.
I'm a pro at this now. Yeah, I can imagine. My first wife must really. She should have an award. What a woman to deal with me right after my head injury. I should not have been married. I was far. Did you say who me?
Yeah, I said who, your first wife me?
No. But you know, I think you met me after my you didn't know me before my injury. You met me after my injury, I think. But my first wife didn't know me prior to the injury either. Yeah, I was in college and she and I married and didn't last long. I was too new to the head injury world and gave too many.
Were you married before we met in college? Did I meet you? I think I met you in the. It must have been the 90s. Well, no way.
No, it was in the 80s. It was in the 80s.
The late 80s. Yeah. So
yeah.
It was like maybe 88, 89, something like that. So
yeah.
When did you get married?
It was actually after I returned to. School, so that was 80. It was 87, I think. 87.
I don't think I knew you then.
Yeah, I was already divorced before I met you. Well, technically, we weren't divorced. We were just separated at that point, when living separately and remaining friends for a while until it was no longer. But that's what happens. Relationships are not easy after brain trauma, especially when your brain trauma affects you the way it affected me. I had no tolerance for anything except my focus. And if you couldn't focus with me, I became impossible to live with. I mean, I can only imagine what she went through dealing with my erratic behavior and my focus, my keen focus and anything away from that focus was to create a hell. So I hope that the people who knew me then are forgiving people and appreciate that it wasn't always just Terry, but the brain trauma patient survivor. I mean, we get better over time. We practice and we learn from our issues, right?
Mm-hmm. We should. Otherwise, we're going to have like Groundhog Day.
I know.
Repeat that thing.
Yeah.
Till you get it right.
Because, you know, we were talking about the shifts in roles, like we were talking earlier about the homemaker unable to be the caretaker of the home, or the breadwinner be the breadwinner. So when shifts in roles like that focus, every even the daily routine, it's difficult to maintain a level of communication that many relationships rely on to stay healthy. So that's when those who've had a brain injury often demonstrate new personalities and challenges and fears and limitations, and the spouses are often surprised by how these changes impact their relationships. So these changes have led many spouses to feel marriage like they're married to a stranger. So we I guess have to understand that when we see marriages fail after that trauma. And one of the other possible problems after brain trauma is a sexual relationship, and that's a reality that most adults engage in. So couples will experience a change in their sexual relationship after brain injury. I mean, there are various emotional and physical reasons for the change, like hormone levels change with the injury, roles in sexual relationship change, appearance maybe, or self-confidence and or attraction, areas of sexual interest.
Well, also
interest.
Personality.
And
remember
personality.
I said personality.
Exactly.
So there are a lot of things going. For the most part, you know, relationships are balanced. And anything that throws it out of balance could be detrimental, you know. Just like anything where the balance is imperative to success, and communication obviously is imperative also. And that may be impaired, you know. Understanding may be impaired. The people that have the injury are not usually, they are changed in some way. And physically, they're the same, but the internal differences and the personality differences and the choices and the all of those things that may have attracted a mate to you may now be gone, you know?
Good point. That's a great point. I mean, especially impulsivity. You said something about impulsivity, and that's one of the things too, the lack of control. Sometimes with brain trauma, patients tend to be impulsive without that filter that it would stop you from doing something you shouldn't do. That filter gets taken away, and you'll say the wrong thing at the wrong time, just blurt it out, or go off and do something.
I found myself. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, you found yourself what?
I found myself cursing. I would say I would be foul. And I you know, would not use foul language. I was a bit more reserved and in control. And after the brain injury, I had a temper. I was short-tempered. I cursed and threw things and really was just, like, very, just, like, aggressive. I was not, that's not, heart. I didn't grow up with that. I never saw that. I don't know where it came from, but I just became very short-tempered.
How did you deal with that? I'm sure our audience would love to get tips on how, does it last forever? Have you gotten better? And how, did you do something to make it better? How did that work out for you?
Yeah, I did have quite a bit of therapy. And then I recognized that I was different, you know. I mean, I recognized it, but I did go and get some help. And so with the therapy and anger management and all that stuff, it did actually make a difference. It really helped. Really helped.
If you could summarize anger management class into a few sentences to kind of give us a tip, what did they teach you? What did you learn most from anger management?
Just more recognizing triggers and avoiding
avoiding situations that would cause me to be upset or angry or stressful. So there were things that would happen that may or may not be in my control, but I needed to just recognize what happened before and then try and get myself maybe out of that situation or diffuse it before it happened. So it's just more recognition, to be honest.
So I'm hearing seeing a pattern. So as a part of your coping mechanism, then you would recognize a pattern, and when you see that pattern starting, intervene before it happens, a preemptive kind of reaction by not reacting or not speaking or not saying something or doing something differently?
Right, if possible, before something made me angry or I had a little feeling that things weren't going well, then move, do something different, get out of the way, whatever. Just do something that was not going to continue down the path of anger. So take a walk, leave the room, excuse yourself, and just recognize that I had to just kind of recognize that things were getting a little bit out of hand, or I was not happy, or I was feeling anxious, and then make a change.
Okay. I think that what you said for me, I can totally identify with the nature, going outside, getting a feel of nature in the sky, the trees, feeling the breeze on our face, and kind of being a part of life again, part of the physical world.
Yeah. You know what else helped that I didn't think would help? I was very angry about it. I was told to do some brain training exercises, Sudoku and puzzles, and that would
manipulative.
Just draw my attention and focus, yeah, away from whatever it was, and I solved the problem. And it got me calm and relaxed and focused on something else. So that really helped. So changing the surroundings, recognizing situations that would trigger me to be angry, upset, or whatever, and focusing on something else.
So you did it completely without the aid of medicine?
I don't remember what medicine, if I had. I may have had some medicine for a while. But the therapist was able to lead me towards some coping mechanisms, the things that I maybe just you wouldn't think would be helpful, like Sudoku or a crossword puzzle. You just thinking, oh, carry these in your bag, and if you're feeling anxious, do that before you go to bed. Do a crossword puzzle before you go to bed. Work on your Sudoku. Try and solve those. And it really kind of just recentered my brain away from being anxious or upset or whatever was going on. And I started getting my memory back. I don't know how those exercises did, but I did quite a few things at the same time. Exercise,
when you say get your,
diet,
when you say,
vitamins.
When you say get your memory back, you mean like memories that have been lost or your memory improved? You stopped forgetting things so much.
I stopped forgetting things so much, and my memory did improve. Both.
So you didn't necessarily get things that you had been lost, didn't come back to you all of a sudden?
I still have gaps of events that I don't remember, and I have pictures that I see myself, pictures of myself and things that I know I'm there in the picture, I just can't remember the thing at all. So there are things way back and past things that I cannot remember. But
it's like, how do you know what you don't know,
right?
Right.
So some of that stuff is not there. I mean, I have proof because I've got a picture, and maybe the picture is me in it, but I don't remember ever taking it or what happened, you know. And it's not like a baby picture. These are like pictures maybe I should remember. Maybe they're 20, 30 years old. I don't know. So I have certain things like that that never came back. But every day when I was able to drive a car, but I could never remember where I parked. And I mean complete erase. I mean, I would park on the same spot. I would park on the same floor of the garage, all kinds of things that I would try to do to cope and remember my car. But from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock, I would forget. And I would totally not remember coming to work, not driving, not parking. And I had to park closer and closer to my office to where I could basically see my car from the office.
Well, this sounds intense. For you to be back to work soon after this, how are you able to function with your job with this? It sounds early after your accident.
I think it was a few months, maybe 6 months. The thing was, I felt okay. I didn't know, like you say, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So I didn't know the knowledge gaps until I tried to exercise that part of my brain. So I would get a phone call, and I would talk to somebody. We'd have a conversation. But as soon as I hung up, I couldn't tell you who I talked to. So I was taking copious notes. And, you know, just not remembering vital things. So it became obvious that I wasn't able to do my job. And I needed help. And that's when I went more for the intensive biofeedback. And I just did everything. Like I said, diet, exercise, therapy, and other whatever.
The biofeedback, I don't know much about that. Share with our audience, what was that experience like for you?
It was, I went to this brain balance center, this brain center, and it was a brain mapping. So the therapist used these electrodes, and she was able to actually see via these electric waves which part of my brain was working well, not working at all, getting too much stimulation. So this brain mapping, she was able to focus and see what part was having a problem. And then she assigned me some things to do to work on those. And so the biofeedback, I was able to do little exercises and I don't know. I just remember doing these things. It's almost like I was watching a television show and moving things with my brain. I don't know. It's a very interesting
moving things with
concept.
Your brain? You mean
like
telepathy?
I would have these electrodes on my head, like these little wires hooked up, and they would be all in my hair, across my forehead and everything. And as I concentrated and watched something on television, I was able to move, say, stack up stones by using different parts of my brain. It's
on
really
the computer.
Hard to explain.
On the screen?
Yeah,
you can see it on the screen? So your thoughts
like
would
you
actually
have something on the TV.
Oh,
and when
like
I
a
did
monitor.
Something, like a monitor, it's a TV. But there would be a program running, and that I ran with my head, with my brain. And so when I did the relaxing, or the breathing was right, it was all monitored, blood pressure, breathing. I don't know how much it cost. But anyway, once all of that was hooked up, I would watch a particular program or a show, whatever it was. But it wasn't really a show. There would maybe be stones I need to stack up. That's the only one I remember, that there were like these stones in the water, and part of the task was to move them.
Which you could do mentally.
Move them in a particular way.
Which you could do mentally.
Yes. Yes. It had to do with your heart rate and your blood pressure and being able to control certain parts of your brain. I don't know how it works.
That's absolutely amazing. I would like to participate in something like that, to actually see that in action.
I did it like every week. So in the beginning, I went every day before work, or 3 days a week or something like that, for 30 minutes. And I wasn't able to do any of it. So slowly, I was able to do some of these tasks that she gave me.
Well, obviously they worked, because you returned to your job even, and have been promoted beyond since then. So something worked quite well for you.
Something worked. I did get it back. It wasn't overnight, but I worked really hard. It was almost a full-time job trying to remember how to do everything. And some things still escape me. I'm not that great. But I forget words. And
well, you know, that's a good point, Michelle. Michelle, that's something so relevant to our audience. If you're listening and new to this world, some things will get better. Some things will improve. But at the same time, some things will be with you until the rest of your life, until the end. We just learn how to cope with them. We learn coping skills.
Mm-hmm.
Coping mechanisms.
Right.
Like, you just learn to deal with it. With that note, I think it's time for a music break, Michelle.
Oh, music break.
I think it's time for a music break. I think. You have any requests, or should I just grab something?
I'll grab something.
Just grab something.
Oh, that one. Yeah.
Listen right here.
That
right
one
here.
That's in your hand right now. Yeah,
Richard
yeah.
Schuping. Actually, Richard Schuping was actually a guest on our show years and years ago. This is the 78th episode, by the way, of our show tonight. Our 78th episode.
What?
I know. We've been on here a while, and Richard Schuping was a guest. Out of this world, man. Really, 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 really out of this world. And he let us use his song on the show, River of Light. Check him out on YouTube. Richard Schuping, River of Light. We'll be back in 5 minutes after the River of Light.
Thank you.
Richard Schuping, The River of Light. Yes.
Nice.
We're back. We're talking about tonight with love and romance after TBI. So The River of Light is what we're seeking tonight with our topic. So thank you, Richard Schuping, for letting us use your music on Brain Injury Radio Network on Surviving Head Trauma and get us to The River of Light and relationship and how relationships are typically affected next, I think is our next area. And we've already covered a lot, but there are quite a few things left here for what happens. So the next one is how relationships are typically affected. Responsibilities. Okay, we understand that. We've already talked about maybe the breadwinner is no longer the breadwinner or the homekeeper is no longer the homekeeper, but we have to do something
right.
About those skills. We have to make adjustments, somehow evolve beyond what used to be into what will become if we work together at this. So how do responsibilities typically change? Survivors often give up many responsibilities, including work expectations, household chores, while they focus on getting better. And partners often must take on many responsibilities formerly managed by the survivor, such as yard work or physically maintaining their home through chores and repairs or managing household finances, planning and organizing activities for the family. So goes on. So you expect those things, and when you don't get those types of necessities after the trauma, it's not good for the relationship, for the survivor, or basically anyone in the scenario. So you agree that we're on the right track here, Michelle?
Yeah. I mean, it takes a big commitment for one person to row both sides of the boat. And a lot of people aren't up to the task. It's just difficult, very difficult. And
yeah,
sometimes it's too much to ask.
especially depending on the severity of the, remember we were saying earlier that a lot of this depends on the severity of the head trauma, because some cases can be considerably more severe than others. So
right.
With that in mind, we have to ask ourselves, well, what happens when the responsibilities change? And anytime people have to take on a new responsibility and then learn a new handle, or learn how to handle a new task, they will also experience more stress. So in addition to the stress of the journey and recovery, the stress of changes in the responsibilities can increase tension between partners. So that underlying stress can become bigger and bigger depending on the level of role reversal or role acquisition. Partners who have significantly more responsibilities will have less time for other things. In contrast, survivors are focusing on getting better and may feel like they have more time. And this can result in different expectations about how much time partners have to spend together. So there's so many different variables in this equation that it can become, it can go either way. I mean, it depends on the two people and the, like we said, the severity. But we do have tips on how to improve the relationship issues related to responsibility changes. One is being understanding. Basically, I'm sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, basically, yeah, you've covered some of that. But right, understanding and knowledge that, hey, the person that I had before, I've got to understand that things have changed. They may look the same, but their abilities, temperament, mood may be different right now.
And it may or may not be permanent. Maybe it's a temporary change or attitude adjustment. Maybe it's only for a year or 6 months.
Right.
Or it could be forever. I mean, there's really no way to gauge it until you experience it and live through it. So the question is, are you in it deep enough to give it a chance to try? How long are you willing to try?
Yeah, it varies. I mean, I think I was kind of down for maybe a year or two. It was coming back, but a good year for me.
I can beat you. A year is good. I have one that was 8 months.
Well, I mean, I still say now I have some issues. You know, I do have some bits and pieces that are not where they were. For the most part, though, I'm coping.
But you're happy. Is that the bottom line, that you're happy?
I am super happy. Right now, with what's happening in my life, where my kids are, I'm working on them. They're just progressing so well and growing up to be nice young men, making good choices, and my 16-year-old going to college. He's enrolled in a dual enrollment class. The other son, he's able to recognize when he's having a bad day and verbalize, oh, I need to come home from school. I'm not doing well today. So I think they're a lot more in touch with their feelings than I ever was. And I tried to make sure that they feel free enough to tell me what's going on with them in school, that they're not being judged, mad. Not saying I'm not going to get angry, but I want to know what's going on.
You've opened up that channel. You've opened up the channel for them to communicate with you.
Right, right.
Which I think is a generational improvement. I think in each generation we get closer and closer to nirvana, if you will. But because I think our parents in our day, we weren't as open. And then when we became parents, we want to be a little bit closer in a different way and open up so that our children will come to us with things like that we would not have gone to our parents with. So it's an evolution, I think, a growth, each generation getting a little bit more evolved.
A little bit more involved, doing things a little bit differently, making some different choices. Are they right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Kids don't come with rule book or an instruction manual.
And
so,
you know what will complicate it? The external factors. There's so many external factors now with social media. My goodness, in our childhood, we couldn't imagine, except on the Jetsons, about teleconferencing.
Cyberbullying? What?
Right? So there's so many different elements they have to contend with these days in this modern
right.
world.
Right. When somebody didn't like you, they just X'd you out of the yearbook or didn't call you. Now,
that was it.
It's like a whole... Yeah, it's like a different thing.
Well, you know what?
How many likes?
That's what it is. Yes, that's it. That was it. The number of likes. These kids were so obsessed with likes that their whole ego system was based on their acceptance level was based on their likes, and they had to do things
right.
to get likes. And I felt so bad for that generation of just pressure to be seen or heard, to be recognized.
Right, and some of the choices that the people are making to get likes. What lengths will people go to in order to have a high social status or whatever it's called? I don't know. I'm not into it. But you're missing out. I do know this, and I have been guilty of it. You miss out on what's happening now.
The here and now.
Don't miss the moment. I went on this date, and the fellow was like, and I was late for whatever reason. I said, look, I was trying to call him. I said, I was running late. I tried to call you. And he's like, listen, I don't carry any phones, and I don't do social media, et cetera, but I definitely don't, when I'm on a date, I don't take my phone with me. And, of course, his kids were older, whatever, live with wife, you know, his ex-wife. So he didn't have that concern. But
right.
I do keep my phone. I keep it on vibrate. And I, you know, am attached to it. I don't post everything. Nobody, very few people know I'm here except for everybody listening.
Except for a listening audience.
So, you know, but you know, I need a break. You need to get out every now and then.
Especially if you're able to. If you're able to do it, do it. Because we only have so much time on this, what I like to call our spaceship, soaring through space, planet Earth.
Right, spinning in the universe.
Spinning, or it's moving so fast, we can't even tell that we're moving. So,
right.
Let's talk about some of the short
to be miserable.
Mm.
Too short to be unhappy. It's too short to say, I'll do it tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness, we're not
and
guaranteed tomorrow.
You're not guaranteed tomorrow. And as long as I'm breathing now and today and that I have a chance, I'm going to do some things that make me happy. I'm going to be with people that have my best interest at heart. And I'm going to try and avoid things that bring me stress or make me upset, and just seek happiness, you know, happiness and love.
And you know, my thought, Michelle, what you just said is my answer to the universe's big question, why are we here? And I think the ultimate form of success in our existence is happiness. If we can find happiness throughout all this chaotic world, that we've been the most successful person, because we've seen that even celebrities who are super wealthy and all, even have all the fame and fortune in the world and still not be happy. They've taken themselves out over the years. We've seen it. So I mean, happiness is something rare, something hard to find. So as long as you're not hurting anyone or doing anything bad, I think everyone is going to die of something. The question is, how do you want to live? And you should live in a way that makes you happy. Make yourself happy, because you only get but a little bit of time on this ride.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. People don't focus on how do they want to live. They get so we, I'm going to include myself in this, we are so hung up on tomorrow and bills and the schedule and, you know, the kids and what's for dinner and carpool and issues at work and that coworker. Not everybody is for you. Not everybody's going to like you. Not everybody's going to get along with you. There are going to be some mountains for you to climb. And I kind of feel like the problems will keep coming. They'll just come faster, more furious, and maybe slightly differently. But they're going to come to you until you learn how to navigate them and solve them. So till you learn how you operate, how you solve problems, how you get through the day, what makes you happy, you're going to keep coming, approaching obstacles and things that you must face and must fix and must finish.
And you know, that fits perfectly into a relationship, because if you don't have yourself together, it's much harder. Even if you meet someone after the accident who's not comparing you to your pre-brain trauma, even if you meet someone new, those things you just said, Michelle, are things you want to get yourself into the habit of doing, so that the person you might meet is dealing with a, as you said, organized, all the things you just said about getting your life together. You've got to get it in order, structure somehow.
Right.
Get those coping skills down for the fault. You got to identify your issues, accept some of the flaws. You can't repair something if you don't recognize the problem.
But accept the flaws, accept the triggers, understand they're there. They may not be going anywhere. They may be, they may go away. It may take a while. You may have to do something. I don't know. But the point is to just continue. There's no need to be sad. There's no need to blame anyone. But the situation you're in right now at this moment is going to change. Everything changes.
Nothing stays
now,
the same.
Will it get better? Nothing stays the same. Will it get better? I don't know. But it's definitely not going to be the same in 6 months or a year, and maybe won't even be the same tomorrow. That's just reality.
Well, there's the other side of that, Michelle. A counterpoint to that, though, is that if it is the same, if you are in a rut, for example, in a relationship, it's the same. That's the time you might want to create change. If it's a repetitive life that's creating repetition so much that it becomes boring to your relationship, you might want to think of ways to spark it up somehow.
Well, I mean, that's going to be true in any relationship, not just brain trauma.
This is true. But we've always decided that a lot of brain trauma issues cross. Cross market into the real, well, not
yeah,
real world, but you know, non brain trauma world.
Yeah, it's not like it's mutually exclusive.
Yeah, exactly.
Covering.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but there are tips though to improve relationships related to this problem of living after brain trauma in a relationship. And one is that we understanding of the new person's responsibilities and have a positive impact on the relationship. I mean, it can, but it also is, it's natural to focus on oneself when a person is overwhelmed. So partners must take time and effort to note all of the new responsibilities that their partner is managing. Noticing and talking about these challenges can reduce tension within your relationship. So at least acknowledge what the person is doing and address it and not just ignore it. Because sometimes if you feel ignored, that can be worse than anything. I mean, if you're doing something and you feel as if it's being taken for granted and the person doesn't even appreciate it, it makes you want to do less of it, I think.
Oh my God, nothing worse.
Well, it's certainly Yeah, it's a tip for helping people to keep in relationship, at least off the tension edge in that department. At least acknowledge what your partner, the new roles that your partner is taking on, and the new responsibilities, and acknowledge them. Give them some type of say thank you. Make a commitment to yourself to thank your partner at least once a day for attempting to manage new responsibilities. And
right.
Schedule. About saying thank you?
No, I was saying, you said schedule, be thankful. Well,
yes.
Be thankful for what they're able to do. Be grateful that you still have them.
And to comment on it.
We oftentimes take for granted our situation. There are very few things that we really need, housing, clothing, food, you know. Beyond that, it's all extra. So we have a lot to be grateful for, even in times of turmoil. And I'm not really trying to go down a religious path. We could, but great gratitude, we talked about that one time, that gratitude builds the positive nature in your heart, that just finding something to be grateful for each day.
Gratitude.
Is so powerful.
Yes. I know you said you wanted to go down the religious road, but I think of prayer when you say religion, and when I think of gratitude and energy. I mean, I'm not a religious person by any means. I don't want to say I'm anti-organized religion, but I'm not religious. Oriented, I tend to see things differently.
I am.
But I do believe in a power of prayer, and you can call it prayer, meditation, whatever, but I believe that if you take the religious view of prayer, if you take 10,000 people who are praying for one thing, or that same energy, I believe, whether it's religious, even if it's not religion, just 10,000 people with that kind of that mental power, like you were saying, you could control on the screen with your mental ability, right? If we get 10,000 people focused on doing something positive or achieving something good, I think that power can be manifested into good without religion. It's just an energy. It's an energy field. It's a force that those people together combined with all their energy focused. It's like a laser beam, I think. And if we focus that beam together collectively, we can, like you, move things on the computer screen, or in our case, reality.
Right. There can be a shift.
So it's about mindset more so than religion. I think it's about understanding the power of the human mind over what we've been taught and given. So sometimes irresponsibly for the riches of of those who would control the masses. But not that I'm anti-religion. I just see the fallacies in it and the controversies in it and the divisiveness in it, the war
started
by it.
Well, there are controversies in everything. There are disagreements.
There are, but a lot of it is, you know, and a lot of the power that we...
Let's not go down there, because
you're
right.
Different show.
Yeah.
But there are roles that we have to contend with, and scheduling opportunities to take breaks from those responsibilities is necessary as well. Like you right now, for example, in Cancun, you are doing something that's not only healthy for yourself, but everyone in your orbit. Because if you take care of yourself, you're a better person to deal with. So these breaks may be short and may not be as frequent as desired, but when couples or even individuals, as in your case, this or with friends and family schedule time off of duty from each other, that they honor and commit themselves to practical and emotional well-being. So you're doing something that's healthy, not only in a relationship, but for your own personal development.
Right. I mean, I consider it to be very similar to putting on the oxygen mask. When you're in the plane, you put your own oxygen mask on before helping others. And that is just so that you are safe and able to help. If you are not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Put your mask on. Take care of yourself. And that is kind of what I see this getaway, the short break, as a chance for me to get away and take care of myself. Have adult time with adults that I like to be with, not doing kid stuff, not being with my kids, giving them a break, giving my ex-spouse some space to do whatever he's doing, and, you know, just kind of R&R therapy for me and getting myself back refreshed so that I can be the best that I can be for my family. That's it.
And that's essential. It's an essential, that's it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily take a trip to Cancun. If your time or your budget or for whatever reason your accommodations can't accommodate something like that, you find a way to escape in other ways.
Go across town, go visit a friend, go to a coffee shop. A $3 or $5 coffee might be a splurge for you. It might be just do that and you're in a different location, different scenery, different people, and just go and be there for an afternoon. You may not have a week or a day or three days, but you might be able to carve out a few hours, even 1 hour, that, you know, you can do something. That's why women go and get pampered or girls vacation or hair and nails polished. We do these things for us. Maybe it's not necessarily for a spouse or for me. It's because I feel good when I look good and I'm taken care of. And that's one thing that we neglect as mom. We neglect ourselves. We're doing these things for the family and the children and this and that. But you can't neglect yourself. You just can't, because everybody suffers.
And you need to have a healthy mindset. And that, if that helps you have a healthy mindset, that's essential to your well-being then.
Right. That's right. So food, you know, your diet, exercise, activities, stress monitoring, all of those things are just vital to be managed so that you can come back and fight another day, work another afternoon, change another diaper, whatever it is. If you want to be able to do it, you've got to be operating at your full potential.
Which means also rest. And somewhere close to it?
Yes, diet, exercise, rest. All is a nice balance. So.
Well, here we are. Tips. More tips. We have more tips.
More tips. More tips.
More tips.
Which is it for your relationship as a brain injury survivor, and good for your relationship as a human being?
Because you're right. They're not, like you said earlier, they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, one applies to the other. So, but in our academic approach, though, we do identify where the role changes occur and talk about those changes openly. We've already said that we should acknowledge it and thank the person. But partners should also be sensitive to the feelings of the survivors. And for example, the survivor may have felt pride in his or her work before the TBI and may feel sad or frustrated when asked to step aside. So it works both ways. You know, the patient or the brain injury person must recognize the caregiver, but the same way the caregiver has to understand, is a mutual degree of understanding each other, of what the losses and gains have been. So partners can serve as mentors and consultants for one another. couples can ask one another what works best for you when you are in this situation. And although survivors may not be able to manage a former role, such as being in the financial decision maker, they can share their knowledge with their spouse. Both partners will benefit when this approach is taken. So even if you can't do what you used to do as well as you did, there's some sharing you can have with your mate who's taking on the new role. So sharing each other's experience, that's, I think, what we're trying to say in this part of the lesson. And if you understand each other's sacrifices and their commitments and their responsibilities, it helps to not only acknowledge it, but to empathize with it, to really feel it and genuinely appreciate it and do your best to understand.
Well, right. Recognize the strengths and abilities of your partner and appreciate them for what they're able to still do. Appreciate them and let them know that they're valued. That's generally going to be the impetus to improve, work harder.
Into a positive direction.
You know, positive reinforcement. Reinforcement.
Because the opposite direction of that is a negative direction, which is because that's important that couples must be conscious of not criticizing the partner who is taking on the new role. For example, it's unlikely that a girlfriend will handle a challenge in the same way her boyfriend would have handled it. Partners should work hard to support one another in their new roles. It includes being patient with the time it takes for everyone to feel comfortable. So not criticizing is just as important as acknowledging and being grateful.
Right.
So we then realize that family and friends may need to be taught about brain injury and the changes it brings. Children who live at home will also benefit from the direct discussions about these changes. And it's a matter of communication. That's the key word. Everybody understands what the role assignment is and understand what it takes from that person who's doing the new role or having the responsibility of the new role. And hopefully it will work out because, I mean, when we started this episode tonight, the first thing was, yes, it can work out. But in reality, we know that oftentimes it does not work out. I mean, depending upon, and just all sincerity, when the accident happens and the two people involved, because each couple is going to have a different dynamic. So it just depends upon how your orbit floats.
Okay. What floats your boat?
Well, you know, communication is the foundation of a relationship. So many people think that when they think of only talking, when they hear the word communication, but couples can actually communicate through gestures, facial expressions, emotional reactions, and physical interactions as well. So in studies on relationships after brain injury, communication is often reported as the biggest change people notice. So for spouses, additional responsibilities and the uncertainty of recovery can cause the spouse to feel overwhelmed. We understand that. And when overwhelmed, people often change their communication styles. So some common changes can include talking less or talking more and or communicating more intensely or urgently than before. Some spouses may be unsure how to communicate with the partner. Because after the trauma, the person is not always predictable. Sometimes you can fly off the handle with the slightest wrong word choice. So this discomfort may cause spouses to not communicate as often or as openly with the survivor. So for both people, increased stress levels often affect communication. So we've got to work on the stress level. That's important. And we've learned that comes from openly communicating, just being a good communicator, but learning how to communicate when. Sometimes it's not always what we say, but when we say it. It's about timing.
Mm-hmm.
When you bring up something, you should know the right timing.
Right. Well, it's kind of hard, the right timing. Sometimes it's hard to know when to approach. There are definitely probably, I'd say, worse times to say something. If you know your partner's a morning person, maybe it's best not to try and have a heavy conversation before you go to bed. Or if they are a morning person, catch them in the morning. Make it known, oh, I want to talk to you about something. Can we talk tomorrow or Tuesday or whatever? You know, make it formal that you're going to have a conversation. And then also be clear about what your goals are, what you want to accomplish by having this talk, what the problem is, clearly be able to identify where you're going, where you're starting. And the communication is so important. You know, you're right. It's amazing.
It's a foundation. It's a foundation, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's for both people. I mean, both people benefit from this when they communicate, but there are tips for communicating also. I mean, both
mm-hmm.
partners should make a commitment to improve communication. You have to make a conscious decision to say, all right, I'm going to try my best to communicate and improve communication, because communication, like we said, isn't just about what we say. It's about our gestures, our posture, the tone in which we speak. So we have to commit ourselves to not only saying the right thing, but our presence, how we behave in front of our partner, with our partner, next to our partner. And we have to learn to listen patiently to what our partner is saying, because oftentimes we become so impatient with what we want to express, we don't actually hear what the other person is saying.
Right. I'm guilty of that, too.
We're editing in our own minds what we're going to say next and not really hearing what we're being told or what is being said to us. So we've
right.
I think we're all guilty of that. You said you are. I am. I think we all are to some degree. I mean, unless you really practice listening, listening becomes a skill almost.
Mhm. Yeah, it's definitely a skill, definitely something that may require a bit more work, may require you to be uncomfortable or do something differently, I don't know, but yeah.
Well, one of the advice we get from this lesson plan here is that if we listen for points where we can agree rather than focusing on disagreement. So we hear something in there that triggers something positive, we jump on it and expand that part rather than focusing on the disagreements. And then when you do disagree, think about what you might say before you say it. Remember that survivors will be much more likely to will need more time, rather, to think about what their partner's saying, so, or about how they want to communicate themselves. So both ways. When you're the caregiver, for example, you've got to realize your partner may need more time for you to communicate it. So if you disagree with something, take the time to express it at a rate that it can be digested. And the same is true for the survivor. Understand that your partner needs to understand what you're trying to communicate. So take the time to think about what you want to say and then say it, if you can, calmly rather than hysterically.
Right. I mean, obviously that's a way to, and it a way to communicate without raising your voice. The louder you yell does not make your point true or more correct or make your partner listen. It will probably enrage them and they will listen less. They'll have the
further distance
opposite.
Them, yes. Exactly.
Yes, if you are speaking loudly or angrily or whatever. So
it reminds me of an old saying, don't raise your voice, raise your point.
Oh, correct. Oh, that's so perfect. That's exactly.
Yeah.
That's a perfect word. That's a
you
perfect
have to get
statement.
Yeah. You don't have to get louder. Mm-hmm. Just make a better point. Make your point
right.
better. Yeah.
Yeah.
So another advice
well,
is
how are we doing on time?
How are we doing on time? We have 10 minutes, 19 seconds. Until the
wow!
end of
oh my
February's
gosh.
Session. Yes. So we can get a few more notes.
March.
In. Yes, right. Now, oh, that's right. Next month is March, which is Brain Injury
yeah.
Awareness Month. So
yes.
we'll have a kickoff. If you check Facebook, we'll have special posts throughout the month of March giving our silent voice some sound. The silent epidemic gets a voice in March, the month of March. Yes. So
yeah.
join us next month. In fact, next month is the 26th is our show in March.
Mm-hmm.
February. I'm looking at the calendar if I can get it up here to March. We are 1, 2, there are 5 Thursdays in March. We're number 4, so we're the 23rd again. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah,
just like
yeah.
tonight.
28
How
days
that?
Good.
What's that?
Yeah. I said there's 28 days in Feb, so that makes it end up being the same. Third week of March is still the same number, same day.
Yeah, yeah, exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Same place, so same bat channel, same bat station. Only
station,
people our age
yeah.
will get that. I guess the younger people will say, what the
Your
hell is
age,
he talking about?
But...
oh, yeah, I'm older. Okay, so my age. You never watched Batman? You don't remember Batman?
Batman. Yeah. What's the point?
Well, I tell you what, the next thing here we have is we just said that patience is the key because survivors need more time to think about what the partner is saying or how to communicate. So patience is the key. And then taking notes on your thoughts during the conversation rather than immediately saying what comes to mind is an improvement. Come back to these points later after you've had time to reflect. So that's a great idea. When you're in the middle of a conversation or argument, just rather than reply or counterpoint with some off-the-wall thought or first thing that pops into your head, write a note, make a note, and just hold on to that note until things have calmed and you can go back to that note and either find it relevant or toss it in the trash can because you decided that it was irrelevant. So the next one is exchange bulleted list of important points for big discussions. When you have something you would like to say, write it down before a discussion and use it as a guide. Trading these lists after a conversation helps with memory and allows more time to digest and think about the information. Now that's one I've never tried. Have you ever tried that one?
Which one?
When you both make a bullet list of decision or points you want to discuss
uh-huh.
and then exchange the list and after you've had the conversation and so that you can remember everything that was said and use that guide as your reference point from the conversation and then trade.
I have lately the past year I've been writing things down communicating via email. So, yeah, I have been doing a bit more writing down.
Well, this is trading, though, actually trading with your partner, the specific issues you'd like to discuss and It sounds fun. I mean, I'd kind of like to do that without maybe a mate. Which is, I don't know. It just sounds like a good idea. Because oftentimes we say things and we get distracted by the comment that we get off topic, and somehow we're no longer discussing what our objective was, that we're talking about something in left field, you know? So to stay on track, if we have an outline like that, we might not end up discussing the topic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we start out talking about what's going to keep us together and end up talking about the finite details of a divorce because we lost street, get off topic. We changed course. So I think that's a good idea. I like that. I like that one a lot. And of course, when a topic is likely to cause a disagreement, practice what you would like to say before you start the conversation. So if you know it's going to be a trigger point or maybe something that is going to likely start something, have something prepared.
Right.
Have
start stress. Mm-hmm.
Listen for it. Can you
right.
Can you hear me?
Be aware. Yeah, I can hear you. Be aware before it becomes an issue.
And have maybe some pre-planned counterpoints or reactions to the response you might get. So
right.
Learning how to communicate, it sounds like what we're saying, Michelle, the whole night basically is about relationships working if we put the time and effort into them, and that includes effective communication, not just talking, but effective communication.
I'm here still.
Which not only is, excuse me, I'm trying to sip water without sounding like I'm swallowing a gallon of water, but but I think I lost my point here. But we do have to discuss it, and discussing it in a way in which we understand each other. That's where I was going with it. We have to comprehend each other, because if we both talk
right.
and don't grasp it, it's a moot point, and we find ourselves in circles. So you might want to even practice in front of a mirror, like look at your facial expressions, your gestures, your body language.
Right.
Also
right.
choosing your words carefully. Choose your words carefully. Certain words could, the difference between words, single words sometimes can make a big difference. So choose your words carefully. And when you talk, try to stick with what you practice. So we have 3 minutes left to
mm-hmm.
say. We have 3 minutes left to thank our audience for listening to us tonight. And hopefully someone out mm-hmm. there in a relationship has learned something about maybe making the relationship work, or recognizing that it's time to fold, because sometimes you do have to fold. But you have to know
okay.
the difference. You have to know the difference between when it is and when it isn't. Because we wish you the best. In fact, for your grandmother, we say, we wish may all of your pains be champagne. All of your pains be champagne. No heartaches, no physical pain, just champagne. In my side,
yes.
I like to say, we're in the audience
champagne.
And on the stage at the same time. So enjoy the ride. Enjoy the ride on our orbit. And on our spaceship in this speedy galaxy we're flying in right now.
Well,
isn't that what we said earlier? Happiness was the hardest thing to find, but the most expensive thing on earth, the wealthiest acquisition is happiness.
Happiness, yes. I think that's it.
Yes. Well, thank you. Well,
we want to thank
Craig Cecilia. Craig is a, mm-hmm. is a great guy. He has a show on the network, and we have 90 seconds left. But Craig, thank you for supplying the airwaves for us to talk about this silent epidemic. And Kim Justice, thank you for managing all this all this management, the station channels, the shows, the hosts, the everything that's involved in that. And we'd like to thank every night of the week, we have a different show, so all the hosts and all the shows. And in our last 60 seconds, Michelle, would you like to say anything special to our audience and wish them well?
Well, yeah, wish everybody a great weekend. And I'm just so grateful that I've got you and that I've got good friends. And we all ought to try and come up with a grateful list. And that should definitely help.
I like that.
Anxiety.
Yes. A grateful list. A grateful list. Yes. Let's do that. Let's start a grateful list. And check out Surviving Head Trauma anywhere books are sold. And Surviving Head Trauma, the Facebook page, and TerrySmithBooks.com for all of our previously broadcast podcasts. So thank you for joining us tonight. Michelle, thank you for joining us all the way from Cancun. We hope you enjoy the rest of your visit there. Yes, cheers.
I will indeed. So, thank you very much for checking on me.
Yes, thank you for joining us this evening. And to our audience, we say good night. Whether you're listening to an archived show or tonight you were with us live, we love you. We wish you the best. And we will see you here next month. Good night. Good night, Michelle.
Good night. Good night, Terry.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.